In this episode of Supervision Simplified, we are talking about the importance of assessments. Do you assess your supervisees or interns? Should you? Why? And what do you use? That's what we'll be talking about and more in this episode. Check it out.
Welcome to Supervision Simplified, the podcast that's here to rock your supervisory world. Our mission is simple yet powerful: to educate and elevate counselors, social workers, and psychologists, empowering them to serve their communities at the highest level of fidelity and service. I'm Dr. Amy Parks. I'm a child and teen psychologist, a group practice owner, and a supervisor in Virginia.
And I'm Valerie Harris, a trauma and attachment specialist, group practice owner, and a supervisor in Tennessee. Let's make it simple and dive right in.
Hello, and welcome back to this episode of Supervision Simplified. I'm Dr. Amy Parks.
And I'm Valerie Harris.
We're so excited again to have you back with us. We hope that you are enjoying our episodes about supervision and all the things supervision related and the revolution we are trying to inspire around more information, more training, more supervisors, more, all the more. And in preparation for more, we certainly know that we need to step back and do some assessments. And so we've talked about that and kind of look at ourselves and look at our skills and look at the skills of our supervisees. And so in our episode one about assessment, we were talking about some specific ones that are specific to the field that have been researched and we've looked at that are very aligned, particularly with clinical supervision. And Valerie and I also both know and both use a lot of other assessments that are outside of that. So we want to talk a little bit about that today, outside specific assessments that we think are valuable in supervision and in working with supervisees to help assess skills, to help assess bias, to review case conceptualization and, strengths, weaknesses, all those kind of things. Also, we like to look at personality. And so all the different aspects of those. And so, Valerie, tell our audience, and I'll share mine too, but tell a little bit about why, first of all, like, let's go back to why we think assessment is important.
For me, in terms of like supervision, and you'll see me looking off a lot because I'm looking at the notes on these assessments. You know, I think that it often gets forgotten that new clinicians are not as well prepared as a clinician with 10 or 15 years of experience. And it's very easy to think that we know that on a clinical level, but I feel like what I made the mistake in is really not even considering their level of development professionally, their level of development as a person, and just in terms of interpersonal awareness and having insight into their own patterns and thoughts and beliefs. And so, you know, when you have traditional students and they're younger, or even some non-traditional students who are older, but are just, this is a second career and a very different career, it's just really easy to have this distortion of competence around, okay, this is a full-grown adult. They're going to tell me when they're not okay, you know, because they're a professional and I'm telling them it's okay to tell me if you're struggling, you know, or they're going to know when they're burned out, for instance, because I've said when clients cancel and you're excited about it, come talk to me, because that was a sign for me. And so where assessment became really important, at first it was more so about a lot of team building, really understanding the dynamics of our team so that I could be a better leader, understanding myself better and how I show up in a room and how that affects other people and things I need to be mindful of, such as being deliberate, which is very difficult because I'm an extrovert that just thinks out loud and that can overwhelm others. So I have to slow that down. And so that's why I feel assessment is important. It's across the whole spectrum. It's not just to help you know yourself better and understand how you are similar and yet different from others, but to understand those that you work alongside, help to understand those you lead. But then that last piece, and the piece that's been kind of the bigger part for us more recently, is understanding those more nuanced areas that clinicians or supervisors may not pick up on, and really helping to model this with clinicians that assessment is good, and we baseline, and if we're modeling that in supervision, we're far more likely to model that in working with clients.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I know that we feel, you know, one of the reasons why we do assessment is those are all very similar reasons. And also, you know, we really feel like it's important for clinicians to be able to supervision seekers or supervisors and supervisees to be able to also look at their relationship and how they're relating to one another, how their development is working as they're working towards autonomy. How are they developing, and how are they perceiving themselves in relationship to their supervisor? So yes, that's another part of the why for us. And so when you're picking assessments, I know we've talked about an assessment. Go back to the last episode. I think it was two episodes before this. We talked about assessment and supervision part one. We talked about some specific items, but we're going to talk about a couple new ones today. What are some things, you know, how do you feel like, not which assessments, but how do you feel like it's best to do assessments?
You know, I will do a little caveat because I almost stepped into a space and didn't know that was, you weren't supposed to do that. So I will say, if you are a group practice owner and you are hiring people, you need to check with somebody who is an HR person, or look into that and be really aware that we know this already, but we just forget it, I guess. But, you know, I feel like assessment was my last class, and I feel like I did the worst in it on my NCE, oddly, or not assessment, sorry, career counseling. And it wasn't that it was bad. I think I was just really tired by that point. So yeah. Assessment was good, but you know, career counseling was all about those certain types of assessments that are for that. And so one thing to really be mindful of is if you're trying to give assessments to someone that you have not hired yet as part of an interview process, you have to be really careful about that, because if it is something that is not normed and standardized for that a particular thing, then it can be discriminatory. And so just lay that out as a caveat.
So what if the supervisee doesn't work for you?
I think that it could be, I think it would be an informed consent. I think it would be something that you would, so for instance, when we have people who want to either work with us or intern with us, we have a series of questions that they answer. One of the things that we ask is, what is your Myers-Briggs type? If you know your Myers-Briggs, and we say, here's a link to a free test. We know it's not perfect. We just like to get an idea because it helps us understand how we might be able to connect to you. It's not an official, you know, version. And then we ask them, what is your Enneagram or tri-type? If you know it, and we know you're not defined by a number, we think it's fun. And, you know, so we caveat it with, this is not going to affect whether or not you are able to come with us. It's just more so going to tell us about you. Whereas if someone was applying for a job and I were to say, hey, I would like you to take this Colby assessment, because it tells me how you solve problems. And if that's not been normed necessarily, and they're in the interview process, and that's not been normed as something that should be given for something of that sort, then it could be risky. It's not like there's a hard and fast rule, don't do it. I've just been told you always want to be really mindful and careful, because if for some reason they don't get the job, could they then say that assessment could have been used and that assessment, you know, wasn't culturally appropriate, or was it, you know what I mean? So it just kind of opens the door. So I just put that out there as a caveat because I learned that.
That's great information. So this is certainly not advice for how to hire or how to be prepared for that kind of process, but it is important to be thinking about what assessments that you're using in your supervision process. Are they culturally appropriate? Are they appropriate for the supervision relationship? Do they have relevance to the supervision relationship? Because certainly it would be inappropriate to be asking anything that has nothing to do with the position or the responsibilities or the tasks at hand, the job in itself of being a supervisor or a supervisee and being a clinician. But oftentimes we know that supervisors throughout the US are not employers of their supervisees. So that's not always a typical arrangement. In fact, it's often not the arrangement. And so they might be managers, they might be colleagues, they're most often colleagues, they could be professors. So there are a lot of different opportunities for assessment that doesn't go into that sort of gray hiring area. So just in case any HR people are out there or lawyers are saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe they just said that. We are not attorneys.
No,
that is not our area of expertise.
I'm just saying,
that's great.
Yeah, be mindful
great
of
great thing to be mindful of
that you give an assessment, and that's if you're an employer or even a supervisor. You know, what stage of that relationship are you giving that assessment? Always check to make sure that that's appropriate and warranted. And as with any assessment, making sure that the person being given the assessment understands the purpose of the assessment. So, you know, an anxious student could think, oh no, is this pass or fail? Like, am I in trouble? Like, why? You know, so it's important to say, hey, this is something I do with everyone. Here's the reason why. I want to just really understand how you work, how our relationship is working, and it gives us a starting place and somewhere. So it's always important to remember to not assume that they understand why this is happening. And, you know, that informed consent, just like it would with a client, has to go the same way with someone that you are employing, who's under your supervision, or someone that is outside of employment, but someone that you have a supervisory relationship with.
Yeah. And I do think it's very critical to say, this is why I've chosen this assessment. This is why we use it. You know, if at any time you find this to be problematic, I'd like to bring it in for discussion so we can have a discussion about it. That doesn't opt them out necessarily, but it gives an opportunity for then further exploration of, you know, what this means to us as in relationship and supervisor supervisee relationship, as and also in the clinical space. So any opportunity for more conversation I think is super, super valuable. And so that's kind of the how and the why of the assessment process. What kinds of things do you think are important, or do you particularly pay attention to when you are giving assessments? Like, so you already mentioned some anxiety, like the pre-assessment piece of like some anxiety around it happening or being given. So we can certainly touch on that, but I'm more interested in what are the things that you want to notice, maybe green, yellow, red flags in assessment, post-assessment?
So really initially with the ones that I use, I go through psych surveys. And it's really, really affordable. It's probably the only system I've ever heard of that gives something free. It's like $5 a clinician and no charge for clients. So we add the clinicians as a client in the system. So, but they can be added as both a clinician and a client so that they can take the assessments as well. But every fifth one is free. So there's that. And I'm more so,
Shout out to Psych Surveys, who might want to sponsor our podcast. We both are big fans of Psych Surveys.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm not really, again, here's the P in my Myers-Briggs. I'm not really looking for anything. I'm just looking from a place of curiosity to see how they're showing up initially, what the interpretation is of our relationship, and how I can support them. I will say, there is at least one assessment that I give, and I am looking at things to see if there's any neutral responses or lower, because I feel like when you're new, if you're putting neutral is either you don't want to be negative, or sometimes a neutral may be I haven't really experienced it either way. And it really truly is a neutral. And the one that
I have some fear around giving an answer here.
Right. Which is why I think it could be explored. One of the ones I really enjoy is the professional quality of life scale. Mm-hmm. And it looks for, it basically is looking kind of like as a way to measure if there's burnout. Mm-hmm. It looks at different dimensions. And it, I'm trying to go to the report. So
is that a psych survey assessment?
It is. Yes.
Excellent. Yeah,
it is. Let me look at one of these really quick and then I can tell you more.
Yeah, that would be great for us to reference. And we'll certainly put a link to psych surveys in our show notes because there will be lots of opportunities to find this, some of these. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it looks at, it gives a compassion satisfaction score. It gives a burnout score and a secondary traumatic stress score. Just as a reminder, we work with complex trauma. We work with a lot of trauma and high-risk clients. It's the nature of what we do. So for me, it is critical that we are keeping that at the forefront at all times. And so I like to issue that very soon. Now I do into the supervisory relationship. And that's even with people who don't work for me, who I supervise on the outside, or even just consulting, who are like, hey, I'm in a new job and I want to do consulting. I'm like, I really recommend that you take this. Totally up to you. But here's why. And normally they will, because these things can be so subtle and so different for different people that I've learned over time that they don't catch it. And it's sort of like when you have a client and you know you can see the process happening, but you can't get the buy-in from them because they're like, nah, I don't think that's what it is. And they're logical and they need that. They need to see it. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, well, that is what it is.
Would you use this same, so I'm not trying to get off topic, but I'm just curious, would you use this same survey, the patient professional quality of life survey, do you think it could even be valuable with interns? Like if we were bringing on interns from universities?
No, I do. Yeah, no, I use it with interns. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
I think
excellent.
It could be good with even certain clients. I think it could be good for.
Sure, of course, yeah.
First responders.
But I was thinking specifically about students because I think oftentimes supervisors don't think of students yet as professionals.
Oh, yeah.
And so the name, you know, like the idea of giving them a professional quality of life survey, maybe I'm thinking I'm going to teach in an hour from now. And I'm trying to think like, how would my students at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, how would they respond to that kind of survey? And I'll go ahead and give it and I'll report back. But yeah. I don't think they even see themselves, even though they're in internship, I don't think that they even see themselves in a professional role yet. So mm-hmm. Curiously, just adding that little caveat that it's appropriate for anyone that is, you know, in supervision or, you know, might require some thought or curiosity, like you said, curiosity around how they're coping.
And what I love about it too is it's teaching them through these questions. So I give it probably every 3 months, and you can set it up on Psych Survey to just automatically populate every 3 months. And it's teaching them what to look for at the same time, right? So
It's
asking these questions and they're answering them, they're going to notice those shifts much quicker. And so it's kind of, to me, creating some internal mapping where they're going to have some bells going off like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, this has changed for me. Like, I don't remember feeling this way last time. And it may be something they're not cognizant of until they go to re-engage that assessment and do the assessment again.
So it's, you know, there are a lot of these on psych surveys. There are many of them that you can Google and reference. Most of them are open field or whatever it's called, like you can just download them and get them. Certainly some of these assessments are available for download as resources in the Clinical Supervision Directory website. Some books have them. So yes. Lots of different places.
The Supervisory Relationship Questionnaire, SRQ.
SRQ, right.
Was developed by, looks like, Myra J. Cooper.
Uh-huh, and okay.
Ellen Binart from both from the University of Oxford.
But going back to that, you were saying that you often give that as well?
Yes. And I do look a little more closely at this one for certain things. Like it asks things like, you know, my supervisor was respectful of my views and ideas. And of course, it has strongly disagree all the way to strongly agree. My supervisor and I were equal partners. Supervisor had a collaborative approach. I felt safe. Supervisor was non-judgmental, treated me with respect, open-minded. Feedback felt like criticism. The advice, was it prescriptive rather than collaborative? I felt I could discuss concerns openly, felt like an exchange of ideas, gave feedback that in a way that felt safe, treated me like an adult. I was able to be open.
A series of really great and powerful guiding questions.
Were they structured sessions? Did they occur regularly? Were they kept free from interruptions? Were they ever cut short? Were they focused? All of these things that I feel all supervisors need to. To me, it keeps you accountable. You know,
right.
I want people to give me that feedback. And I want to know if something's off, and I want them to know that that matters to me and all of those things matter to me. And I feel like the sooner I can put that in front of them and they can know that this is part of supervision and this is important to me. And I want a report card so that right. I know what I need to do or follow up on.
Right. And all of these questions too open the opportunity for discussion. So if, for example, one of them is that I felt like I was being judged, then that's a beautiful opportunity to have a conversation about, you know, can you tell me a little bit more about this and how that was, are there specific circumstances that you can reference where that was interpreted? How can I be better at this? You know, is this something that, you know, we could shift in our relationship? These are all, and I don't think, oh gosh, I can't think of very many people I know that do this. I mean, hopefully they do. Please add in the comments if you use regularly, specifically, you know, assessments around your supervision relationship. But I hope that should be a gold standard. Gosh, we're really setting the standards, aren't we, Valerie? I really think that should be a best practice.
I mean, I think it should, because I think we're human. There's some, right. Like, for instance, one of the things I noticed with two of my newer supervisees is I think both of them on that scale had a neutral response around the acknowledgement of the power differential. And I felt that was kind of interesting, because to me, I feel like I have acknowledged that in many ways. But as I sat and thought about it, I'm like, but I've not had that genuine conversation with just each of them individually. And so when I first year either interns or first year, you know, master's level that just graduated, I do their supervision individually. And then in that second year, I put them in pairs. And then they get grouped the whole time throughout as well. But, you know, so it's really easy to think that you've gone over something or done something, and then you see that and use the rule of twice, you know, both of them said neutral. So it either meant that they didn't know that was supposed to be said, or they don't know what that means, or that I didn't make that clear and talk about that and talk about what that means and what their role in that is. And so now I'm
laughing because maybe it means you're so mean that they don't want to say anything. Crack the whip. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, that's a really good discernment to have. Yeah.
And that's so important. Like the power differential is like the biggest, like, well, I mean, it's no, I mean, I feel like it's one of the biggest areas of potential harm, right? Because of being exploitive and things of all sorts of ways that can go sideways. And, you know, I think that I cover the duality of the role. And I think what happens is in my covering the duality of the role, I assume that that's the power differential pieces coming covered in that. And it's not. Those are two different things. And so had I not given that and saw that, I wouldn't have been curious about that, you know, and imagine, I don't know. I just think that it's important to do it well and do it the way it's supposed to be done. And we're human and doing the best we can with what we have. And so we can make really big mistakes on accident, and we could make really small ones that cause no harm on accident. But either way, the damage is the damage, and you still have ownership in that. So as much as you can mitigate some of that, I think that it's necessary and it's so quick to do.
Yes.
And so easy to do.
And you mentioned that, you know, we've talked about this in the past, and I know we'll have many, many, many more conversations about the duality that often exists for supervisors that is sometimes in their control and sometimes very much in their awareness and sometimes not in their control and maybe in their awareness, and then sometimes not in their control and not at all in their awareness. And that, you know, those dual relationships of maybe being the managerial supervisor and the clinical supervisor and the person that writes the paychecks and the person that signs off on your licensure hours and who, you know, all the things, you know, can sometimes really get super, super muddy. And I love that opportunity in that particular assessment for people to be able to say, I'm feeling some kind of way about, you know, our supervision relationship and that it doesn't feel like, you know, I'm not saying that there has to be an equal power sort of exchange per se, but that I'm aware that there's a power differential and I'm feeling comfortable and safe within it versus like, this feels really, I'm afraid if I say anything, I'm going to get booted.
Yeah.
You know, this is not going to go well. I'm afraid to admit that I can't, you know, I'm struggling because of this particular financial situation at home and it's really impacting my work. And this is the same person that signs my paycheck. Like,
yeah,
you know, like how, that's a lot to deal with. So anyway, that's again, another little detour, but I do think that that's a great advantage to the assessment piece.
Yeah. I definitely agree. I think that, you know, there are so many options on here of even ones. So I was going to look at another one that are not even necessarily driven towards, you know, the relationship or the supervision process or even professional skills. But I think that they can feed into that and without getting into the clinical space. So one of those is let me find it.
And when you say not getting into the clinical space, you mean like not becoming the person's therapist?
Yeah. You're given an assessment. The assessment is not necessarily one that is that could be perceived as though you are trying to make a diagnosis or treat.
Right. Because of course we know we've talked about that. That's not appropriate. Got it.
Exactly. So one of them I like to give also is the self-compassion scale.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks at, it measures, let me go here. I really like that it measures these. It puts the results in several different buckets. It's looking at self-kindness, self-judgment, common humanity, isolation, over-identification, and mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they're, you know, low in one of those particular areas, such as, you know, mindfulness or high in isolation, you know, those are things that we can talk about in within the supervision relationship as it relates to the person of the counselor and right. The importance of being able to, you know, not just do self-care, but what is self-care? And, you know, it's self-care should either create or protect capacity rather than something that's a numbing activity or some sort of like, you know, is more running versus being present. And so those can tip us off on different things, especially when you look at the whole picture of how they're just doing where they are in their career journey. And so I use it for that reason. Another one that I looked at was, I think there were two more that I had looked at. One of them is the brief resilience scale.
Mm-hmm.
So
we use that in our office. Yeah. For kids, but
yeah. Uh-huh. Because I think it's very easy to forget that the capacity that I have and the resilience and bounce back I have took years to train my nervous system to do those things. And so when
Absolutely.
I put myself in the shoes of being an intern, I remember driving home every day from the drug and alcohol treatment center, just crying 2 to 3 times a week. Because I just felt so sad of all the things I heard because I had never heard all those things and just all of a sudden felt like, I don't know how I'm going to make a difference because there are so many things that need help, you know?
Wow, and what a great point. I never really even thought about that. The fact that, you know, in your career, as you become a supervisor and you've been in the field for a long time, you've built up sort of a reservoir of resilience that you know, the people coming in that you're supervising don't necessarily have. And it's not that I haven't thought about it, but I've never thought about it really that way in particular. And I think that that's really amazing. And I love that you can think about a resilience scale like the brief resilience to be able to say, like, how does this then inform what you're going to do to support your growth and your, like you said, self-care only is for the purpose of increasing capacity. Or did you say increasing capacity, preserving capacity, all the things?
Yeah, protecting or creating.
Protecting. Yeah, exactly. And so I think that that's terrific. And then there was another one you said?
Yes. A personal need for structure.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Because I think we all should take that and we probably all score 100.
Yeah. I mean, things like I enjoy being spontaneous. I don't like situations that are uncertain. I hate to change my plans last minute. I hate to be with people who are unpredictable. We have a really diverse team and we're pretty neurodivergent and all over that spectrum. And so again, I am so much about being proactive rather than reactive as much as possible. And so if I see that the resilience level is a little lower and there's a high need for structure, you know, then I'm going to be considering that both as their employer, but also just as their clinical supervisor in terms of, okay, you know, how many high risk, you know, people do they have on their caseload and how long have they been at this? And maybe there's, you know, there's no correlation that I know of yet because, you know, I haven't studied it and it wouldn't be something that I could validate or replicate, but I could start to at least get a felt sense or idea of, okay, at this level of resilience, we need to stay within this amount of risk so that we're not overwhelming the capacity of that clinician and allowing them to push to the edges of their window of tolerance so that they're growing instead of shrinking, you know, because they should never come into a practice and shrink in capacity. And in all honesty, I think in the beginning stages of my practice, that's exactly what happened to several clinicians. And it was never the intention. And it was not that we weren't talking about it. And it wasn't that we weren't trying to do things about it. It was that they didn't understand what they needed. And I didn't understand what would work or wouldn't work. And so I think in hindsight, these things could have really been like guideposts. And so I think I like using them as guideposts now and giving people a language and continuing to have them engage those questions so that they're putting it together. Okay, this is changing or this might mean something. I need to seek supervision on it or let's talk about this next time.
Yeah. The idea of having assessment and using assessment as strategic guideposts, both from, you know, from all the way from internship into really, I always say, well, I don't always say, but, you know, the idea is internship to ownership. You're using these guideposts throughout your career trajectory, and you're using them both as a supervisor, as a supervisee, no matter what stage of development in your career you are in at the moment. And I just think the idea of guideposts can be so valuable for understanding the, like we talked about, parallel process, the relationship, your own personal capacity, your own personality, your relationship to your clinicians or your clients rather, and the society in general and the bigger, greater profession. So really, really super valuable. Anything else that you want to share with our audience about assessments before we close up today?
Yes. I want to share about my favorite leadership coach.
Oh, yes. We brought our books for Michael Chastain. Hello, Michael Chastain.
Yes. he has been my leadership coach for quite some time. And I will say that one of the things that drew me to his work is that he does assessments. And so I have had like an advanced leadership profile, a DISC assessment, multiple different things. And it really was the game changer for me as a supervisor and as a leader in general. And I can't tell you how many of my own staff have been like, you have changed. And it's like they can feel it. They can feel it, and I can feel it. And when I tell you this, it seems like, okay, well, if you were not okay, you should know you weren't okay. But I didn't. I was hearing, I'm overwhelmed. This is confusing. Well, when I meet with you in person, I experience you this way, but in email, it feels this way. And I'm like, and so then I would track my tone in my emails to try to figure out like what is, something is coming through, and I couldn't get it. And so when I did all these assessments and understood myself in a much better way, it really helped me to see why certain things become really important to me, why I tend to move towards certain areas. I am an eye on the disc. So I am all about, and so is Michael, and being an EFP, which means I'm going to have big expansive ideas, and I have to be mindful of really reining that in sometimes and being deliberate, because it can be a lot for someone. And also, not everyone wants to be part of that, you know? And so just if I see potential and I'm like, oh, have you ever thought about doing, you know, that may not be for me to say. It may not be the space, the time, understanding, you know, clarity and how clear is kind, and being able to check that and being able to slow down and ask more questions. All of these things are things that I have had to learn. And I cannot stress enough the power of getting with someone who can issue assessments for you and be a mentor and be a coach, so that you can look sometimes and go, well, what I really wanted to say in this meeting was this. And then I've had one with him where I was like, I really wanted to say this thing, and I hit my face, and he's like, you hide your face. You don't say that. I know. I didn't do it. And having someone hold you accountable and with supportive accountability, like,
hey, and it goes both ways.
Here's your leadership homework. I want you to find three examples of where you've implemented this skill or you've strengthened this. And so I think the point I want to make is that just because you get years of experience as a clinician or even as a business owner, that doesn't equip you to be a leader. Those are different things. And so it's really important that at every stage in your career, when you're shifting into a new thing, that you're really well resourced and that you have the right people around you to make sure that, one, the power is always staying checked and that there's accountability. And two, to make sure that you're not trying to compensate for skills here and use them over here when they're different.
Right. That you're really working and functioning with intention in all of those different areas. And that's something that I know that Michael talks a lot about in his book Changes as well, and as a leadership coach. Thanks, Valerie, again, for all of that and sharing your insights and your great assessments with us today. I really appreciated the conversation. Thanks for tuning into Supervision Simplified. The revolution starts with you. And don't forget to subscribe, download our episodes, and share them with your network. We're so eager for your comments, stories, and feedback to ensure that we're hitting all the right topics that you really care about. Keep simplifying and elevating your supervision game. Until the next episode, we can't wait to see you. Bye. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Supervision Simplified. Remember, the revolution starts here. We hope you'll subscribe and that you'll share it with your friends and colleagues. We also want your comments, stories, and feedback so we can be sure to be talking about what interests you the most. Until next time, keep on simplifying and elevating your supervision game.